Welcome to When Blue Turns Black, a rare and fascinating exploration of true crime. Join former police officer Vonnie T as she reveals intimate details of her career, explores the psychological toll crime can have with others, and shares her own experience with PTSD.
Just a warning, the content contained within these episodes may be distressing to some listeners. If you or someone you know needs additional support, Lifeline is there to help on 13 11 14. In today's episode, I really want to focus on the stress and the pressure that I was feeling in that last 12 months prior to me going off work. There's a job and another little incident that I'll talk about today, and they're not, major critical incidents. However, attending that job led to some pressure, adding of pressure that I felt I was under. And then the other little incident, I felt like I was really unsupported and I sort of had no one I could turn to talk to. So anyway, I'll get into it, but I just wanted you to know before I started that, it's more on the stress and the pressure so that you can understand or maybe have an understanding how police officers can succumb to stress and pressure, just like anyone in any job. Like, I'm not saying that it's any different to any other job, but, there's other factors as well. And this led from my downfall with the PTSD. I was already highly strung and prone to stress and not sleeping and paranoid and, very anxious and not trusting of people. And I was going through it all on my own without even realizing. It's just that around this time, the pressure was building up. I suppose I'll just quickly say that at this time, I had turned 40. I was going through a bit of a year where I just didn't really know what was going on. Like I've mentioned previously, I sort of thought I was going through a midlife crisis, and I put a little bit extra pressure on myself to hit these goals that I wanted to tick off my bucket list. I'd said to myself, I can prove to myself that 40 is the new 30. And, because I was just feeling old, I was starting to feel like, where's my life gone? Where's it heading? I was a bit lost. I sort of didn't really know who I was. And I just wanted to give myself some direction, I suppose. So, I signed up to do the run leg of the Hell of the West. This is in Gundawindi, which was it's a half marathon. I'd never done anything like that before. And, there was all these things that I was ticking off my bucket list. That year I did Kokoda Challenge on the Gold Coast with a group of women from Gundawindi, amazing women. That really tested me. I ended up having quite a decent injury to my hip and my knee and walked pretty much half of it backwards. The Kokoda Challenge, I think it was, we ended up doing 100 kilometres that year in the Gold Coast hinterland. And, it's not something that you just stop and keep going. You had to keep moving through it. I had quite a few mental challenges at that stage doing it. And thankfully I had a really supportive crew of girls around me. But anyway, so what I'm trying to say is I had all of these other personal challenges that I was trying to tick off to prove to myself that I was still worthwhile and that 40 didn't mean that my life was ending. I suppose this is part of the PTSD, being so catastrophic about everything in my thinking and so dramatic about where my life was and where it was heading. I felt like I had these visions of just being in one of those walking frames soon, I don't know why. So I was on this quest to prove to myself. Anyway, this job that I'm going to talk about, it didn't help with what was going on at the time. I had a relationship breakdown with the father of my daughter, and there was a lot of stress and pressure going on between the two of us. And obviously being single mum at the time, it was something that was my decision. I felt it was best for me, but it led to me going back to work full-time, full-time policing, so full-time shift work with a child. And her father worked away a lot, so I couldn't rely on him to have my daughter when I wasn't at work. So that's just the nature of his job, and that's just the way it was. But it definitely made things really hard for me. So the pressure was building up, and then I attended this job. So I'll get into it. I can't recall the date and the time. I remember it was a Saturday afternoon. I was working on my own at this point in time. I was working, I think, a 2 to 10 shift, and there was a crew coming on, I think it's 6 p.m. to 2 a.m., maybe 8 a.m. Actually, I think it might have been 8. So I was just biding my time, covering the shift pretty much until they turned up. So I was doing what we normally do on a Saturday afternoon. I'd been patrolling, and then I went down to watch the football, show a presence and just walk around the football, make sure people are doing everything that they should be, and also sort of fly the flag, as we would say, or wave the flag that, the police are down here and, trying to be a little bit more community oriented with people. At that stage, I was playing league tag with that football club as well. So it was really good to foster a good relationship with everyone and, break down a few barriers with the uniform. So I went down there and, was just walking around and having a chat to people and keeping an eye on what was going on. And I received information from Warwick that there was a gentleman, there was a male driving his car in an erratic manner up a street, and there was kids playing out on the street, and several people had rung in and said, he's going to hit a kid in a minute or hurt someone, or, he's just driving like a maniac pretty much. So I left the football and I went down and I went to the street in Gundawindi, and I spoke with one of the witnesses. At this point in time, I've spoken with this witness before, and then she has not provided me statements and things like that and made it very hard for me with previous matters. So I took my time talking to this person, and she outlined what had happened. She said that this fellow was in the car. She pointed out the residence that he came from, the car that he was in, described what he was wearing. And she said to me, he was driving up and down the street. Like, this is a street that was 50 kilometers an hour, but it was quite a wide street and it was one of the back streets in town. And she said, look, he's just flying up and down here and just making a menace of himself. And I'm really worried that one of my kids is going to get run over, or someone else's kids, because, lots of kids are riding around on their bikes. Not far from there was the near where the cultural centre was and touch football fields and the netball courts, and then there was also the riverbank. So it was like one of the streets that people used, or kids used a fair bit, to go backwards and forwards, go and play with their mates or go down the riverbank. So her concerns were very valid. So I took my time, took a bit of a statement off her, and then I went and spoke to another witness who had also rung up about it, and I took their details and a brief statement off them as well, knowing that I'm probably going to have to take some action against this fellow, and knowing that I didn't see him, so it can make it very hard to put it before a court when you don't see it. Oh, not very hard, but, if I had have seen it, that would have made it easier for me to explain and to say if I had to put a court brief together and charge this person. Anyway, so I went down to the address. There was a young fella there, probably. He's in his early 20s. He had this hotted up old car in the driveway with the gate shut. So he's parked it up in his driveway and shut the gate. As I've gone to the residence, he's out the side with a few of his mates, and I knew some of the young fellas from football. Anyway, I sort of had a brief conversation with him and said who I was and that I wanted to come in and have a talk to him about his vehicle. And he obviously knew what I was there for. So I've gone in, just into his yard pretty much. I've gone over to the vehicle and I've touched the bonnet, and the bonnet was hot. So I just started questioning him about driving the car. And I said, oh, mate, I've had a few complaints about this vehicle being driven up and down the street in an erratic manner. And I see that it's got no plates on it. It's obviously unregistered. have you been driving it? And he said, no, I haven't. I said, oh, well, that's interesting because the engine block is hot and someone's obviously been driving it. So that's consistent with what several people in the street have said to me. And he said, oh, well, look, I did drive it, but I just drove it. I just reversed it down my driveway and just, you know, just on the street there for 1 second or so. And then I drove it back in the driveway. And meanwhile, all the young fellas were sitting there laughing and, you know, and I'm trying not to be intimidated because here I am a single female officer on my own. I don't know heaps about cars, but I've got a few brains about me. Enough to know that the vehicle had been driven and had been driven for longer than just in and out of the driveway. So I continued questioning him and he still didn't want to admit to driving it up and down the street. Turns out I asked him for his license. I also had a brief conversation with the other young fellas that were there and I asked any of them if they had been driving and they were all like, no, we're drinking, you know, and they were on the piss having a few rums and whatever else. And they said, no, we're drinking, we're not driving. So I spoke to the owner of the vehicle again and I said, mate, have you got your license on you? And he said, oh, I don't have my license at the moment. I was like, oh, rightio. So another reason, I'm thinking to myself, another reason why he's not going to admit to driving it. So I said, all right, can you lift the bonnet, like get the bonnet up on the car? I just want to check down in there for a moment. So he did that. And when I bent over the side of the vehicle and down, and I felt down in around the engine block, it was really hot down in there. So I could tell that it had definitely been driven in the manner as the witnesses had provided to me. I was down there for, I don't know, maybe a couple of seconds. I really don't know how long. And then I came back up and I had a conversation with him. I said to him, you know, mate, you're not telling me the truth. You're full of it. This vehicle has been driven for a lot longer than just in the driveway. He did finally admit to driving it. Obviously, he wouldn't say what manner, and I didn't have enough evidence to be putting him before a court for erratic driving or for speed. But at least I had the unlicensed and the unregistered and the uninsured because he was now admitting to driving it up the street and I had witness statements to say the same. So I said to him, look, I'm going to have to charge you. I'm going to go away back to the station, make some further inquiries. I'll come back and I'll see you. And my plan was to issue him with a notice to appear. Now, that's a piece of paper that you can give to someone, which means that they have to attend court. And it, in that, it's got, you know, the time, date, place, the person, and the offence that they've allegedly committed or offences. And it just means that it gives them a date when they have to appear before court. And I also was going to get him to come down and, you know, be fingerprinted and photographed and a few things like that. But at that point in time, I was working on my own and I just wanted to go and make some further inquiries to make sure that what I was charging him with was right, that I didn't have to add on anything else at the end or that I hadn't missed something. And, you know, that's okay to do that. It's a country town. Like I said, I had my statements in my notebook. There was no dramas. I just said to him, you know, when you and your mates aren't drinking, I'll come back and see you tomorrow and we'll have a proper conversation about it then if you want to. And, yeah, and I'll issue you with a court appearance then. So I sort of thought, oh, that's okay, and I left the job. Anyway, I went back to the station and I was sitting there doing some inquiries when a friend of mine rang up and she said to me, have you seen Facebook? And I said, no, why would I want to see Facebook? And she said, there's photos of you on Facebook and there's some really derogatory comments. And I said, what do you mean? What from? I haven't done anything. I've just been working today. And she said, I think you just went to a job where you bent over a vehicle. And I said, yes, I did. So she said, look, you might not be able to see these, which I couldn't because I had a private account. I wasn't friends with any of these people. And I didn't want to look it up. So she came down to the station and she showed me. And the gist of it was, is while I was over that engine block and feeling down in there, checking to see if the vehicle had been driven and, you know, how hot it was, just so I could question him a little bit more intelligently for an offence that he was committing that was putting other people's lives at danger. One of the boys behind me took a photo, Snapchatted it to someone. They've screenshot it. It's gone over Facebook. And then there were comments on there saying things like, oh, wow, that copper takes it up the ass, and things like that. I was mortified when I saw this, and I also took it as a personal attack because I had been nothing but professional when I went to that job. I didn't speak down to the boys. I didn't yell at anyone. I didn't carry on. I didn't anything. I just had a conversation. When I read through the comments, they got more and more derogatory about, and I'm sorry to say this, but about me taking it up the ass and doing anal and all that sort of stuff. And at that point in time, I was angry. I was also really upset with the fact that I was going through not quite a custody battle at that point in time, but, you know, I had to be seen to be doing the right thing as far as my child's concerned, and I didn't need all of these things posted all over Facebook and Instagram and Snapchat about me when it wasn't true. There was no need for any sexual connotations at all. And the most distressing bit for me was that in that same street, in the 2 years, I think it might have been 12 months before that, I had been to a job where a woman had called police because she had been getting bashed by her boyfriend at the time. She commented, I helped her. She commented on this post saying, you know, that slut copper takes it up the ass, blah, blah, blah. I was mortified. Like, I had helped this woman out at a job. I had helped her to get away from someone who was physically violent towards her. And this is how I was repaid. I had someone commenting of a sexual nature about a job that I attended when all I was doing was trying to keep the kids on the street safe. It really made me angry. Now, I rang that guy, the owner of the vehicle, I rang him back and I said to him, mate, I'm so angry right now. I'm not going to come near your address. I'm not going to come to your place. Don't call police or don't call me for any jobs tonight. I don't care what happens. Do not call, but you need to get that post down. It needs to be deleted right now because I am a mother. I am a woman. And I didn't do anything wrong, and I don't need all of these comments and these disgusting derogatory comments about me plastered all over Facebook or Instagram or Snapchat. And you tell all your mates that they better delete everything. I don't want to see it. I'm aware of what yous have all posted. And he originally said, oh no, there's nothing. I didn't do anything. It's not my fault. And I said, I don't care if it's your fault or whose bloody fault it is. Get it off. It's disgusting. And you shouldn't treat women like that. I was just so angry, you know, and just so hurt. And so like, you've definitely got to watch what you do. And I didn't like the fact that people videoed what I was doing. You know, I've got no dramas with police being videoed or with myself when I was policing being videoed. If I've done something wrong, fair enough, pull me out on it or call me out on it. And I'm happy to put my hand up and say what I did or I didn't do and to be disciplined if I need to, or, you know, to learn a lesson from some behavior that I shouldn't have done. But on that day, like, man, it really knocked me because I had been working full time. I was under the pump. I had been broke. I was working really hard just to keep the money coming in. Every day I'd have to get up and take my daughter to kindy. I was getting no sleep. It didn't matter if I was on night shifts or I was on day shifts or what was going on. There was a lot of pressure on me, and also a lot of pressure on me to do the right thing in public, you know, to have that public persona, to have people think she's strong. I felt that if I didn't show people I was strong, and I didn't have that tough image, or not tough, but strong image in public, that people aren't going to want to listen to what I've got to say when I go to jobs. They're not going to do as they're told. They're not going to respect me. And, you know, I didn't see that I could be vulnerable at all. I just saw that I had to be strong. I was the last female left at the station at that point in time. There was no new females coming for a little while. And although, you know, a female can be a bit vulnerable at times, I also felt that it was just really important that, you know, the next time I go to a noise complaint, say, or a noisy party, and I'm asking people to be quiet or to comply with a direction, that they're not going to listen to me if they've seen me crying down the street or seen me fall in a heap. So no matter what, I had to show up every day when I was in uniform or even in public. I just had to show up and not show any signs of weakness, because people can prey on that and people will prey on that. So I think that's why this job, like, it really got to me, because I saw that people that I had helped had turned their back on me and treated me so poorly. You know, I rang that woman and I said to her, like, she was living out of town at this point in time, and I rang her and I said, I saw what you posted and I'm disgusted and I can't believe that you would do that to another woman, and especially a woman who has helped you get through some of the hardest times of your life. You know, and meanwhile, I'm left to go through some of the hardest times of my life, but I can't talk to anyone. There's no one I can call for help, because, you know, a sign of weakness means, like I just said, people in town aren't going to take me seriously. People I work with won't take me seriously. If I start to fall off the rails, you know, they take my gun off me, and then I can't work. And then how do I pay the bills? And, you know, the pressure was just really starting to mount up. And I just felt like I wasn't getting any support. And it was around, just finishing off that job, I did go back and I spoke to that fellow, and I charged him with everything I possibly could, and I put in the summary of facts. That summary of facts is in the court brief, which is a report that I prepare for the court, so that when it goes to court, the police prosecutor reads out the story behind it. And I did put that in the story, because I just felt that it was just disgusting behaviour, and that he had no regard for other people, and that the magistrate should be aware of that, and that the guy wasn't remorseful for driving on the road and putting other people's lives in danger, let alone, you know, ganging up and bullying and being part of a group that's going to bully a female police officer who was just doing their job. And it was also around this time, I suppose, that I didn't feel that I was getting heaps of support at work. I probably didn't help that, because I put on a brave face with everyone. I just kept saying, yep, everything's good, everything's good. I would go to work. I'd be really tired because I'd be on night shifts, and I'd have to get up at, you know, early in the morning, get my daughter off ready to go to kindy. Then I couldn't get back to sleep. I wouldn't sleep again. I'd pick her up in the afternoon. I would have a friend's daughter. She would come and stay. She was in high school. She's in grade 12. She would come and stay while I was on night shifts. I would pay her, but I would also clean during the day. I'll cook a meal for her, cook a different meal for my daughter, and then have food prepared for myself, to get through the night. And all this was just going on just so I could turn up to work. So definitely the pressure was there. The stress was starting to take a toll. And I wasn't talking about it to anyone. I just thought if I just kept motoring on and on and on, that's just what life throws at you, man. Like, I've always been a strong person. You just got to keep moving with it, and then eventually you'll get on top of it. But there was no getting on top of it. It just was getting worse and worse and worse. I couldn't see any light at the end of the tunnel, and that tunnel actually started closing. It just got darker and darker. It was around this time that I was working I don't think it was that weekend. I think it was another weekend around that time when one of the officers, I was one of the other officers, male officers at the station, thought it would be funny to play a joke. Well, that's what he says later on. I went into work and I had been working the shift and I was going to use the toilet. And I went, so when a female officer goes to the loo, and I'm, this is going to sound really ridiculous, but, you know, you got to take all your kit off and put it on the floor. You can't just pull your pants down because the kit, your weight, your belt, it weighs so much. It just doesn't work. So I'd take my belt off, put it on the floor or hang it on the door if there was a handle and, you know, go to the loo. A lot easier for a guy to go to the loo. Anyway, I've pulled my kit off and gone to sit down and realized that there was urine all over the toilet. And then I've picked up my kit thinking, oh, God, I hope it's not all over the floor and there's pee all through my kit. So there wasn't, but when I've had a look back at the toilet, he hasn't just urinated all over the toilet, not just the toilet seat, but all over the back of the toilet where you press the buttons and all up the wall. I just stood there and cried because I thought, I'm the only female that uses this toilet, except for the admin girls during the week. Why would someone do that? And I'm busting to go to the toilet and I don't want to use the boys' toilet because it's the boys' toilet. I just felt like my little safe space had just been invaded and I just felt like at that point in time, no one liked me. It didn't matter if they liked me or not, I suppose, but no one really gave a crap about me. I mean, the boys would complain about being on night shifts and being tired and, oh, you know, the wife didn't keep the kids so quiet today. And I'd be like, oh, really? Oh, well, I'm doing the night shift and I'm picking up the slack for you. Because, you know, I've got to think for you because I'm senior to you. I've got to make the decisions and I've got to show up and make sure that I can make decisions. Oh, and I have a child that, at home that I have to deal with all day or, you know, get to school, can't get back to sleep. I've got all these things to do. I've got to keep my house clean because I have other people coming in to look after my daughter. I don't have that luxury of having someone look after the household for me so I can get some sleep. And yes, one could say that that's my own fault, but that's how it was for me. And so for one of my workmates, someone I liked, in fact, I liked this guy. He used to make me laugh. We had lots of fun when we work on shift together. For him to urinate all over the toilet, it broke me. It was at that point that I realized that I was on my own and it was a boys' club. And even though he turned around later and said that he thought he was just being funny, I think that was just an excuse. And I think that at that stage, other people around me were trying everything they could to break me as well. And meanwhile, I was just trying to be strong and show up and do the right thing, you know. I didn't know anything else to do. Policing was all I'd done for a long time. I loved it. I loved helping people. That's all I wanted to do. So, at this point in time, I did speak to my boss about it. He was so angry and he spoke with the officer about it and he spoke with the other boys and, you know, it's not to happen again. And I showed him what had happened. I'd taken pictures of it. So it wasn't just that I was being dramatic, but it definitely led me further downward into myself. At that point in time, I didn't feel like I could trust anyone. I didn't talk to anyone. All those feelings that I was having inside that had started after I went to Alexis's murder, those feelings of being overwhelmed, of having no support, of being paranoid, they just got worse and I bottled them up more and more and more and I just felt like I was this time bomb that was just ticking. It's funny how we change from things, isn't it? Like After that incident, I would get in trouble sometimes from the boss. He'd say to me, mate, you took how long? Where were you? What were you doing? During the shift, I needed you to get back to the station. I said, oh, boss, I was busting to go to the toilet and I don't use the toilet here anymore. I don't trust using the toilet here. And that's just how it is. That's how it worked for me, it just added to my paranoia. I didn't trust anyone. I didn't trust anything anymore, And I was avoiding people. I was avoiding having conversations with people because I knew I was becoming more irritable. I didn't want to talk to people. So, yeah, the stress at that point in time, I don't know how I got through it. In fact, I did struggle on for another probably 8 months after that, I think it was, until I fell in a complete heap. And obviously, physically, there was a lot of physical symptoms that showed up. And that's why I fell in a heap, because physically I couldn't keep going. Mentally, yeah, I wouldn't say I was strong. I was maybe keeping up appearances. I was having sick days. I was avoiding work. I was avoiding anything really. I definitely was someone people didn't want to be around. But I'll just quickly go on to say that when I did fall in a heap at the end of all of this, I had been away on the Gold Coast with my partner. He was up on the Gold Coast. And I suppose I just want to highlight really quickly for you how this happens. And maybe if you know someone in the same situation or you can see these signs with someone else, you're able to help them. So I went, had a week off, all was good. I thought it was good. At the end of the week, he said to me, you're not right. There's something going on with you. I feel like you're about to have a mental breakdown. And I was like, I don't think so. I'm good. Putting on that bravado still. I'm all good. Everything's great. And he said to me, well, it's not. You're getting 3 hours sleep a night. You're not happy. I feel like I'm walking around on eggshells. You're highly irritable. Like none of us here know what to say around you. It's very uncomfortable. And he said, I can't be around this. And at this point in time, I had no one else to talk to. He was the reason that I kept moving forward, and my daughter, obviously going through the motions with her, but he was my reason to, to get my life on track, because he was my best mate, even though I didn't get to see him all the time. And the thought of losing him was just unbearable. It was too much for me to take. So I ended up admitting to him that I wasn't right. And I admitted that things were terrible and that I was just stuck in this hole that I couldn't get out of. And I suppose voicing that to him made it real. And we ended up, I cried for, I think like for 3 or 4 hours talking to him about all of this. And I said to him, I need some support, because this is something I didn't mention earlier. I had no family in Gundawindi. And so I had no one to rely on with my daughter, and I was just spread myself way too thin. And I didn't have a support network. The few good mates that I'd had recently transferred out. He was one of them. It was actually, I say recently, but it was about in the 12 months before. And so I was just getting further and further isolated. So I spoke to him. Yeah, I spoke at length with him. All the walls came down. And I feel like after that, so I went back to Gundawindi. Spurred on to think, well, I need to get out. I need to apply or get a job or leave town. I need to go. I was under a lot of pressure at that stage from my daughter's father not to leave town, but I just knew that I was just in this really bad place. And I knew that I would have a battle ahead of me, but I suppose, the point I'm trying to make is that when I admitted to there being a problem, that I felt like something unleashed in my body. Because before that, you know, I was more on the angry side and all of that. But after we had that conversation and I went back to Gundawindi, I couldn't stop crying. I would cry myself to sleep at night. I had this tennis ball. This is how I describe it at that point in time. It's like a tennis ball in my throat. It stopped me from, I couldn't swallow properly. I couldn't eat. I couldn't talk properly. This nervous energy just came over me. And I just felt sicker and sicker and sicker. Like, I just didn't feel right anymore. And I feel that talking about it just opened it all up. And then my body was just like, yep, you've accepted it. And now this is it. This is how it's going to be until we get fixed. Unbeknownst to me, I didn't realize that at the time. I just knew I felt so unwell and I just couldn't cope anymore. I still couldn't sleep. So it was like a double-edged sword. I couldn't sleep, but I cried all the time. So yeah, that was leading up to me going off work. But I suppose what I wanted to say in all of that is if you know someone who is displaying that kind of behavior, any of those behaviors I've described today, or, you know, is, you know, that they're keeping things inside and they're not talking about them, encourage them to talk. And don't just encourage to talk, encourage them to get support, whether it be going to a psychologist, go to their doctor. Let's start that process. Let's get them talking and getting professional help with how they can find out what's going on with them so that, and they're given strategies and they're given hope and they're given things to work towards instead of falling in a heap and feeling like nothing's ever going to change and, you know, making a mess of themselves. I've seen too many coppers who are alcoholics. They're just complete drunks, you know, and I'm thankful that I never ended up like that. I'm very thankful, but I'm also, you know, alcohol doesn't agree with my body. I had no money at the time. The money I did have was going towards my rent and my everything that my daughter needed and food on the table and all that sort of thing. So I didn't give in to alcohol, but I could have so easily. And that's what happens. And it can happen to anyone in any job. It's, you know, it's burnout. And it's not just having the conversation. It's about providing support and strategies from there on and just, you know, keeping an eye on them, checking in with them every now and again. I had a lot more to follow from this and I'll talk about that in the next episode. So that's where I'm going to leave it today. Just please take care of yourselves and take care of those around you and those you love.
Thank you for listening to When Blue Turns Black. If you enjoyed this episode, leave a review, which helps others find the podcast, and subscribe for future episodes. For more information on Vonnie and her journey, visit VonnieT-TheResilientWoman.com.